My name is Alex Rawls, and today it's a special pleasure to talk to Rodney Crowell, who has released a handful of Christmas songs throughout his lengthy career as a singer and songwriter. This year, he released his first Christmas album, Christmas Everywhere, which, as we talk about in our conversation, is a product of a guy whose career is sufficiently established that he can make the Christmas album he wants. It's rarely simply joyous, and he takes some unpredictable turns in mood that will confuse some and reward those who appreciate Christmas music that comes with the same aesthetic density that they look for in the music that they listen to the rest of the year. As you'd expect from someone who has had the career Rodney has, the choices are deliberate and true to who he is as an artist. When we talked, he was in the middle of a run of shows in Nashville's Ryman Auditorium, where he was opening for Amy Grant and Vince Gill's Christmas show with one of his own. That factors a bit into this conversation. Where are you right now? Are you home?
I'm in Tennessee, yeah.
Oh, that's right. You're doing the shows at the Ryman right now?
Yes, I am.
How have those been going?
Well, you know, it's a Ryman Auditorium, so that's a heightened experience, just playing on that stage. And then I'm on in front of my friends, Vince and Amy. That's good. And they have such a big production. We're in a little acoustic group, so we're sort of we're like buskers on the stage of the Ryman Auditorium. I think it's pretty cool.
How have the songs been received live?
Well, you know, I can see the audience enough for some of them to go, what is this? which was sort of what I was going for.
Oh, excellent. So I remember when I used to write poetry, that a poem never felt real until I'd read it. And I kind of wondered about, as a musician, as a singer and a songwriter, what happens or how playing a song live fits into sort of the life of a song for you.
Well, it's not official till that happens. You know, like the process is, light bulb goes off or some nudge happens from the other world, and a song comes into play, and then, you write it and you sing it and figure it out. And then if it's good enough, you record it. And that starts to bring it to life. It starts to be firmly, in this time and space, but I've never considered them fully formed until I did put them in front of an audience and see how they perform.
Had there been songs that surprised you or things that you learned about the songs once you saw them in front of an audience?
You mean full spectrum or in terms of the Christmas album?
The Christmas album.
Yeah. Yes, I'm doing Merry Christmas from an Empty Bed with a little bit of a comedic introduction to it. And as they slowly dawns on them, I'm not at all being funny.
Right.
I enjoy seeing that happen and see them. I mean, really at the end of it, they don't know whether to clap or, applaud or, I don't think they want to boo, but it's like, they don't know. It's like, well, what do we do?
Right.
What do we do with that?
Yeah. Was that part of the fun of writing Christmas songs, to be able to put something in there that people wouldn't expect there?
Yeah. I don't think I would have done it otherwise.
Right.
I mean, I really thought about that. Well, I want to make a Christmas album. But I want to make it as real as I can make it.
Right.
About the, you know, about what life is like.
Sure. Why did it take so long for you to record a Christmas album?
I had a few Christmas songs scattered over a 30-year period, three. But, you know, there didn't seem to be any, I mailed out a cassette of a couple, you know, just for kind of in lieu of Christmas cards.
Right.
But then, you know, I heard a song by Hayes Carl called Grateful for Christmas, heard it on the radio. Moved me, and I thought, wow, I want to do that.
Where are you right now? Are you home?
I'm in Tennessee, yeah.
Oh, that's right. You're doing the...
Well, we'd all head to Waco for the birth of our Lord. My folks and my brother in an 82 Ford.
Well,
we'd pull in the driveway filled up with cars, old aunts and old uncles. Lord, I see stars.
In a heightened
And then we'd run to the kitchen. You know, kids and their games. Play fetch with old Buster. Call each other names. Aunt Betty be singing while supper was cooking. We'd unwrap the gifts.
They have such a big production.
Looking.
We're in a little acoustic group, so we're sort of buskers around on the stage of Rhyming on
Grandpa, say the blessing.
It's pretty cool.
Aunt Jane, she fell asleep.
How's the songs,
Mary Kate,
been received?
Burned the dressing. But we got all of our friends and family.
You know, I can see the audience enough for some of them to go,
Christmas
what
this
is this? You know, which is, and so I pondered it for 3 or 4 years. And then I was in Scotland in the winter and kind of, you know, sitting in a restaurant looking through leaded windows, you know, as the snow was falling, and it was real Dickensian, you know, and I was, you know, was thinking about the Christmas Carol and Christmas literature and the whole thing, and I said, it's time for me to do this. And I started tinkering around with melodies and for the rest of that tour. And then when I came home, I wrote most of the album in a very short span of time, which in anymore is, I seem to write consistently, but I spend a lot of time with it. But I wrote the Christmas songs pretty quickly.
Was that because they felt done pretty quickly, or because that felt like the right way to treat Christmas?
I didn't have to, you know, for some reason, whatever the reason, I didn't have to search as long and hard and revise as much to get the language like I wanted it. It seemed like the language was there. I write melody pretty quickly. If I get a real piece of music, it'll be fully formed in a pretty short period of time. And I'll tend to spend, you know, weeks, years, months revising the lyric, trying to get it down to, you know, really solid language. But for whatever reason, and I don't really have any answer for it, I was satisfied with the language fairly quickly.
What did you hear in Grateful for Christmas that inspired you?
The truth. It's a big, fat truth.
So what song came first for you?
For me?
For you.
Well, besides the ones that already existed, Very Merry Christmas and Christmas Makes Me Sad and a little tune with my daughters. I suppose Christmas in New York. That's the one I started tinkering with in Scotland.
Did it? I'm not sure. This may not be a thing you can even sort of sort out. But did it sort of help break the ice, or how did it break the ice? What kind of or was that just the one that kind of came fastest?
It was the first melodic thing that I was walking around with. You know. Tinkering, you know, at soundcheck backstage, and And then I remembered the first Christmas I spent with my wife at the Mayflower, my wife Claudia, my third wife and my forever wife. Our first Christmas that we spent together was at the Mayflower Hotel in New York. And from there, I said, oh, I have a setting, you know. It's like, how do you get the reader into the room? And so I pondered it for 3 or 4 years. And then I was in Scotland in the winter and kind of, you know, Christmas sitting in New York. A restaurant.
Mayflower
Looking
Hotel.
Through leaded windows, you know, as the snow was falling.
When we first got together,
it was real Dickensian, you know. I
didn't
was
know
about
you well.
Christmas Carol and
with popcorn
Christmas
and paper,
and the whole thing. And I said,
"We trimmed us a tree."
And I
that Christmas in New York,
it
was just you
melodies
and me
for the rest of that tour. And then when I came home, I wrote most of the album. Very short
what
span of time, which anymore is, I seem to, and from there, you know, then I took a trip to L.A. And recalled Christmases there when you know, things weren't as great. So kind of took a long way around, you know, to say what I really wanted to say.
Right. Just out of curiosity, what was your attitude towards Christmas music before, I mean, in general?
In general, I don't like it much. My wife, Claudia, you know, she loves it. And there are, you know, there are pieces of music that I hear. You know, I love Dylan's It Must Be Santa. And, you know, there are pieces of music that were just absolutely essential in the world. Jingle Bell Rock, for, you know, for its simplicity as a record, is a, you know, a beautiful record. And, you know, and Silent Night and Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas are superb pieces of music. But for the most part, I always thought that it was very unrealistic,
mm-hmm.
and the mythic side of it, Little Drummer Boys and 12 Days of Christmas never moved me. I didn't believe it.
Yeah. I often think about what, you know, sort of what place those songs occupy, and you know, one of the things I think is interesting is that they feel like they are songs that are simply made to be sung. That they're not really even carrying an idea. They are literally a text
very,
that people
very
can perform.
Very clever. Very clever.
Sure.
You know, and bear in mind, you know, from at an early age, I was really interested in songs and was, you know, even before I knew it, I was going to be a songwriter. So I don't know if it's skeptical, that's not the word, but, you know, I brought a certain amount of editing to that particular music, which is, now, well, we need this, but we don't really need this, you know?
Sure.
But by the same token, you know, the average person out there on the street consuming Christmas time, they wouldn't approach it like I would, you know? You know, it's Christmas music and it's hallowed. And who do I think I am? Passing judgment. Well, you know, one day I was going to grow up and make a Christmas album, and I was going to strive for as realistic as I could get.
Well, that makes sense. I'll tell you what I found fascinating. I recently found the entire lyrics for Santa Claus Is Coming to Town. Which is actually there's actually like 8 verses, and
yeah.
And it's really fascinating that the people who cut it down did the right thing, because partway through the song it stops talking to kids and starts talking to their parents, and partly language also becomes a lot more generic at that point, and that the whole purpose of the song changes. When it goes from being about telling kids what they need to do, it starts telling parents basically, now you need to get out there and start fulfilling your kids' wishes, and you need to take care of the poor. And it's really pretty interesting, but you can also see where the people who decided to shorten the song up kind of had the right idea. So Christmas Everywhere, in the song itself, you have this like really bouncy song, you know, sort of a real fun song, and then it almost stops dead. It stops for Lyra Lynn's verse about the time machine and saving Lennon. And I was wondering where that came from, how that started and fit into that song.
Came from my granddaughter.
Oh, really?
Quite literally came from my granddaughter, who a few years ago when she was, I don't remember if she was 5, 6, 7, she's a pretty exceptional child, and she crawled up on Santa Claus's knee in the mall, and she said, he said, well, what can I bring you? And she said, a time machine. Because I want to go back to the day John Lennon shot, because I know I could save him. So that, you know, that magic moment has been in my family, you know, and I realized when John and I were composing, John Jorgensen and I were working on, you know, the kind of gypsy jazz flavor, I said, John, I want to take this into a dream. And I want to put what my granddaughter said, you know, into this dream sequence. And we found the way in and we found the way out. You know, pretty much recorded it just like that.
You have this like really bouncy Christmas, song.
Christmas,
you
know, Christmas, you know, Christmas, you know, here again.
Christmas,
Christmas,
stopped,
Christmas,
dead.
Christmas, Christmas, where then? Deck the halls, it is a season. We don't need no rhyme or reason. It's Christmas time, go spread the cheer. Pretty soon, gonna be next year.
How that started fit into that song?
Came from my granddaughter.
Oh, really?
Quite literally came from my granddaughter, who a few years ago when she was, I don't remember if she was 5, 6, 7,
as long
pretty exceptional child, and she crawled up on Santa Claus's knee in the mall, and she said, well, what can I bring you? And she said, a time machine.
A time machine.
Because I want to go back to the day John Lennon shot, because I know I could save him.
Back to the day John Lennon.
So that, that magic moment that's been in my family, you know, and I realized when John and I were composing, John Jorgensen and I were working on, you know, the kind of gypsy jazz flavor, I said, John, I want to take this into a dream, and I want to put what my granddaughter
Christmas,
said.
Christmas, Christmas, Christmas,
you know,
Christmas makes me happy.
Into
I love Christmas
this dream
cold and gray. I love it sweet and sappy. Just crazy kissing cousin Flo.
Where were the rest of the lyrics at this point? Was it because I'll tell you when I was hearing the song for the first time, that the thought itself is like so, you know, is so specific and so interesting that it almost felt like everything else was built to get to that moment. Is that true?
Well, I would say that the end result does bear that out for sure. And I think now when the song is being played, you know, I mean, we've been doing it live, you know, on the Ryman Auditorium. And what I want to do is get the audience to the real message, which is the dream sequence, you know, the John Lennon, saving John Lennon. So even though we started, you know, my original idea for that song, at first I was thinking, you know, I want to do something like Spike Jones, you know, for his Christmas, you know, and and do the horns and the whistles and, you know, the all the things that Spike Jonze would do on those records he made. But I realized that, no, I don't want it, you know, I don't want the music to be that cartoonish. And that's when I called up John Jorgensen. I said, I think gypsy jazz is the way this needs to happen, this to carry this narrative I want to get to. And then I realized that I wanted to get to the John Lennon part. And so the end result is exactly what you say. I mean, I have the same experience. When we play it live, I'm thinking, I can't wait until we get to this part for these people who haven't heard it. Because, you know, we're going to pull the rug out from under them.
How does that play in the room?
Plays well, you know. It's, you know, they think the song's over and then this happens and then it comes back. You know, it's a Christmas audience and we're going off to trying to reverse the murder of John Lennon. It's fun to do.
Right.
It's fun to do.
Is it hard at this point to surprise your audience? Because I'd imagine your audience has been with you for a long time. And so,
well, that's, you know, that's a good question. I think maybe the album I'm working on right now, I'm mixing a new album. I think there are elements of it that are going to surprise the audience. I think they're going to hear some things that I've never done before. But to circle back to the Christmas everywhere, I think that that particular moment surprised the audience for sure. And, you know, and I would like to think that, you know, my next favorite piece of writing on the album is basically my version of Santa Claus is Coming to Town, which for me took the form of When the Fat Guy Tries the Chimney on for Size. And, you know, I give myself the liberty of saying, hey, that's a pretty good piece of writing.
Right.
You know, to look at it just from a writer's point, man, I got the words right. And from the first time that I jotted down that phrase, when the fat guy tries a chimney on for size, I think I delivered on the potential of that title.
Where were the rest of the lyrics at this point? Was it primarily, I'll tell you, when I was hearing the song for the first time, that the thought itself is like so, you know, is so specific and so interesting that it almost felt like everything else was built to get to that.
When the fat guy tries a chimney on for size, don't believe your mean big brother's lies. Just leave your milk and cookies on the hearth.
Bear that out. Sure. And I think now when the song is being played,
when you hear the fat, you know, guy sleigh bells,
I mean, we've been doing
snow.
It live, you know, on the Rhyme and Auditorium. And what I want to do is get the audience to the real message, which is, I'm happy and pleased with that, and hoped maybe that the my particular audience that kind of sticks with me would go, wow,
yeah,
he did that.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
How did Christmas Inviter come to be?
Oh, conversation with Mary Carr and I. When I first went up to New York and started coaxing her into writing songs with me, you know, she's a memoirist and a poet and a language scholar and teaches, you know, memoir and creative writing and at Syracuse. She heads up that department, creative writing department. And she's also from the same part of Texas I'm from, basically. And we became good friends. But early in our friendship, you know, I was coaxing her into collaborating on some songs. And that was our second song. And it actually came from a conversation that we later circled back and wrote. She was talking about her mother. She said, God, you know, every other Christmas, my mother would say, okay, let's skip Christmas this year. I'm not into it. So that conversation led to us writing Christmas Inviter, which is, you know, just a narrative about a particular part of East Texas where, you know, the chances of having a good old-fashioned Christmas are far and few between. I'm happy and pleased with that. And
it's Christmas Inviter. 88 degrees. The taco stands
kind of
padlocked. Spanish moss hanging from the trees.
Yeah.
Flip flop sticking to an asphalt road.
How
the whole damn town is decorated to implode. My lawnmower dies with a cough and a moan. Ain't nothing around here you'd want to stick a bow on.
How'd
I wind up down here, you might ask?
Memoirs and a poet.
For that story, brother, you're going to have to pony up cash.
I plan
to leave with a man dressed up like the president. We got him a union card, but we never went.
And she's also from
no fun.
Same part of Texas.
So we got him a basketball, and he got him a gun.
We became good friends.
He got
but
me a duplex. He got me some kids. We was gonna go to Astroworld, but we never did.
And that was our second
It's Christmas Inviter.
And it actually
it's Christmas Inviter.
That we later circled back and wrote. She was talking, and later on, you know, when the record started taking shape, I rang up Mary and I said, hey, you know, we got to go back and revisit our original idea about let's skip Christmas this year. So we traded emails and got a narrative going for that one, too. So that's how Christmas Inviter came to be. And we discussed different places in Southeast Texas. We talked about Christmas in Baytown, and we talked about Christmas in Conroe. But we thought Viter sounded like the most, you know, insidious name.
I'll tell you, I'm in New Orleans, and so anytime I'm driving to Houston, I drive through Viter.
Yeah, you do.
And it's always struck me as like the place for people who couldn't cut it in Beaumont. Rightly or wrongly, it's like that was sort of what I saw, and I was like, yeah, this is the place where two sort of two people who are living on the kind of living on the edge, and whose lives are falling apart around them. Yeah, of course, somehow they'd end up in Viter. And
the good news is, and I haven't gotten in touch with Mary about this, but we'll have a great laugh. There's a lady bought the album and it circled back to me that she was wanting her money back. Because she lived in Viter, and she thought we were being unfair to Viter. Well, that was great. I actually wrote her an email saying, well, it could have been Conroe, it could have been Baytown, but don't you think Viter sounds best? And she's like, well, yeah, you put it that way. Yeah.
Oh, I think the fact that she has that, the fact that she got an email back from you right away is like, if I was a fan and I wrote to complain, and I got an email back from Rodney Crowell, I'd be okay with Christmas Inviter.
I think she was. I think it worked. I wanted to dismantle it. Sorry. But I also, you know, it's like I really got a great laugh at it because, you know, when Mary and I were writing that, we kind of hoped for that kind of response.
Is it hard to get in the heads of characters like those who are, you know, pretty different from yourself?
Oh, those characters aren't that different from the way either of us grew up.
Ah.
You know, I grew up in East Houston. You know, I mean, it's semi-tropical. You're in New Orleans, you know, it's semi-tropical. It's Christmas time. It don't feel like no Christmas, man.
No. Actually, I grew up in Houston. I grew up in Sharpstown.
Okay, well, you're across the way. I was in Jacinto City, you know.
Okay,
so.
Yeah.
But you still know, you know, it's like, it's ship channel mentality, you know, common labor, basically. And I mean, really, it was Mary who came up with a line, you know, we were going to go to Astroworld, but we never did, which I thought, perfect.
Right.
That's perfect.
You know, one thing I was thinking about, because it's a sort of song that, again, because I kind of know the territory, and I I spent a lot of time as a kid in Astro World, that I was wondering if this is a place where you could, you know, where fans who don't know Texas can make the mental translations and know, okay, Christmas and Vidor. Vidor doesn't sound like a place where you want to end up. And even if they don't know that a drive to Astro World is probably about a 3-hour drive or something, they can still tell that, you know, that everything about that sort of sounds like all kinds of wrong.
Yeah, and you know, again, it was Mary's line about the far end of the driveway is as far as I'll go. You know, I think that probably says more to the broader, you know, that would speak to somebody in Jersey, in the island of Jersey, you know, about, you know, well, you know, the end of the driveway, as far as I'm going to go, it's that translates to just about anywhere.
Right.
The specifics of getting from Vidor to Astro World, you'd probably have to pull out a map and see that. But by the same token, you know, we very consciously said, well, you know, a lot of people aren't going to get this, but I don't care. We do.
Is that a license that comes with having had a career or having had the career you've had?
I suppose it does because, you know, in some ways, it would not be truthful to say that I don't care.
Right.
That's far from the truth because I do care and I take my jobs seriously and I want to do the very best job I can. But first and foremost, it's, you know, as a writer and as an artist, you serve the narrative that's the most true. And for that particular song, it had to be Christmas and Vidor, and it had to be all of those things, right down to the Prozac and beer.
Right. Well, I would also imagine that you've been at it long enough, and that you have now given, you know, you've found your audience. You've also, and you've given people sort of a reason to buy in and a reason to, at some level, trust you. And so even if you're taking them into places that they don't necessarily know, you've given them a reason over the course of the years to say, stay with me, this will pay off. And do you feel that at all?
I feel that way about a large portion of the people who follow me. Mind you, you know, when I was top 40, you know, during my 15 minutes of fame, no.
Right.
I wouldn't, you could not presume, people are hearing you on the radio and connecting to you that way and projecting stardom onto you. I mean, one false move and you're out. And I did that. I made false moves and I was out. But the audience that has stuck with me and became, it's not a large audience. I always say it with, you know, quite honestly, oh, I'm a middle class artist. You know, my following in terms of size, in terms of the whole spectrum of entertainment, I'm squarely in the middle class. But the audience that follows me, it seems like, you know, 70%, maybe a little bit more, are there for whatever I want to do.
Right.
And then there are, you know, another, maybe let's say 25% that'll check in from now and again and, you know, might hear something that's, you know, just sounds good, that might be pleasing to them, that's not about investing themselves in this sustained narrative that I've been presenting for a while.
Sure. You know, I mean, I was thinking when I was listening to this record, and I was thinking about Dylan's Christmas album. And the fact was that if you're buying a Dylan Christmas album, I mean, a Dylan album, Christmas or otherwise, if you're listening to a Dylan album in the 2000s, if you're listening to Dylan now, it's because you're interested in Dylan. And the detail, the specific details of a specific song or album, you're interested, but they're not what brought you to the game. You got in because you're interested in Dylan. And I would imagine that's a lot for a lot of people, that's the case with you, that people who are now invested in you as an artist. And, you know, it seems like what you want to hear from many artists is, what are you thinking about now? And whether that's political, whether that's Christmas, whether that's love songs, or, you know, whether that's whatever it is.
Yeah, whether that's something I have in mind, you know, after I finish this record that I'm working on, that it will present a particular narrative that is going to be pushing it pretty far, you know. So we're going to see how brave I am, and we're going to see. I got the songs together for this thing. They're there, and it's ready to be made.
Well, that's
and
great.
We'll see how far I can push it.
So, what do you see as the through line between the Christmas Everywhere songs and the rest of your body of work?
Huh, that's interesting. I guess probably one particular friend of mine, an Irishman who's quite sophisticated, consumer of music, you know, he said, you're a correspondent.
Huh.
And which basically is bringing observation back to, you know, back from the field is how I interpret it. So I think maybe it's my observations that are that glue that we made, that, you know, that kind of nebulous glue that we're talking about, and why people pay attention to what I do over and over again. I like to think it's my powers of observation.
Yeah.
But then again, yeah, you know, you have to be careful that you don't give yourself kudos that aren't really justified, you know.
Certainly something to think about, and, you know, it seems perfect, and that's a perfectly reasonable thing to hang your hat on.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in all honesty, I think that I cultivate my observational skills in day-to-day life. I look at a lot of things and I pay attention. And I look at them perhaps the way a sculptor would look at something, you know, that they wanted to make out of solid material. I'm making it out of sort of a nebulous material, which is notes and sounds and words and music and... So, you know, when I look at the David, you know, I've seen the David, you know, and I look at that and I said, wow, what a great observation of a male body.
Right.
And it's so epically done, you know. So, you know, the great artists, you know, are great observers.
Right. So does that mean you're talking about, you know, so you sort of train yourself in sort of staying observant. So you're noticing, like, when you're just sort of walking around, you're like noticing what's distinctive about this person, or what's distinctive about this, or what's the detail that you need to know to be able to ever bring this person back, or
well,
the situation back.
I'll bring it back around to, I'm in Glasgow in Scotland in January, and it's snowy. And I'm in an Indian restaurant sitting by leaded windows, you know, right out of, you know, the 19th century or before the 18th century even. It's very Dickens looking, you know, there's a street lamp, snow. And I'm looking out that window, and quite honestly, looking out that window turned into an album.
Wow.
And it was me observing the tone and the atmosphere and you know, seeing this, you know, my imagination being inspired. Now, I didn't come back and write, you know, about leaded windows or, you know, a Dickens Christmas. I came back and wrote about what I wrote about, you know, from a, you know, a man living in Tennessee, having grown up in Texas. But that particular moment is still, I still, eyes open or eyes closed, I still see that out that window, I see the light. I know how cool the air was around the window. Those are the kind of things that inspire art, you know, artists to make, to do the work they do. Or, yeah. I mean, not just me. I'm just pointing that out as a particular observation that turned into an entire album.
Sure. So the album ends with All for the Little Girls and Boys. And that's you with your kids, right? When in the 80s?
Yeah, that would have been in the 80s. Must have been, well, let's see. No, that would have been, that would have been mid-80s when my daughter Chelsea was young, maybe three. And my two oldest daughters and I wrote it on the living room floor and, you know, a bunch of wrapping paper on a Christmas morning. And that's the original recording that I made with them way back then. And all I had was a cassette of it that was left over. I certainly didn't have the multi-track. So we just mastered the cassette. Those are the kind of things that inspire art, you know, artists to make, to do the work they do. I mean, not just me. I'm just pointing that out as a particular observation that turned into an entire album.
Sure. So the album ends with All the Little Girls and Boys. So why include that song?
I think probably more than anything so that my children could hear themselves sing when they were kids.
Oh, that's great. Well, that kind of taps into something I was thinking about. I was, you know, kind of, you know, wondering if you need, you know, if you feel like you needed to touch certain bases over the course of the expanse of an album and ending up as, you know, as dark and as sort of as sad as the album can be at times, to end up with maybe the one sentimental note on the album, you know, you singing with your kids. It's like that kind of feels like the natural ending to this journey.
Well, yeah, I mean, I certainly put it on there saying, well, you know, this is real sentimentality here. And it is part of the season. And, you know, occasionally, you know, there were brushstrokes throughout the album that bordered on sentimentality. I tried to make it, you know, sentiment, you know, the sentiments have a bit of edge, you know. But that was, you know, true. I mean, it's like putting a home movie on at the end of, you know, a fine film, an art film, you know.
Right.
And but I wasn't worried about that because, I mean, I really hadn't thought about it. It's the first time I've been asked. But in truth, I just put it on there so my children could hear themselves sing when they were 3, 5, and 8 years old.
I also talked recently to singer Casey O'Rourke of New Orleans funk rock band Flow Tribe. Every year during the week before Christmas, they play a holiday show at Tipitina's. This year, it takes place on Friday, December 21. And for the occasion, the band has recorded its first Christmas song, Hammered on Christmas. Casey and I talked about the song, the art and commerce of Christmas music, and the thought process behind writing Christmas songs, among other things. Here's that conversation. So how many years have you been doing the Christmas Crunktacular?
So this will be our 10th year. So I guess we started in 2008, and it's always been a tip of Tina's. There may have been 1 year at Rock and Bowl or something, but yeah, so it's just kind of a annual celebration when everybody comes back in town, and you know, we get to, for the most part, you know, a lot of New Orleans musicians are back in town too. There's not a lot of touring going on in December, so it's a great opportunity for us to reconnect with all of our old friends and have a bunch of special guests and you know, do some holiday tunes that we wouldn't normally do. And yeah, especially with this year, with releasing Hammered on Christmas, our Christmas song, that, you know, it's going to be great just to kind of tie all that stuff in together.
Well, it's that time of year, the season for cheer. Got them jingle bells on. Under the mistletoe, with the warm fire glow, the whiskey's holding me tight. Before I go under, won't you give me a number? I feel like my arms are all dead. Don't bring me no booze, cause we're all getting loose. We're hammered on Christmas again.
Is this the first Christmas song you wrote?
Yes, this is the first Christmas song we wrote. So I guess I wrote it probably 2 years ago. I'd come back from a Christmas party and was feeling kind of loose and was like, all right, well, you know, the one through line, I guess, in my Christmas experience has always been getting together with my family and being Italian Catholics. You know, they like to knock back a couple, and yeah, it always seems to bring out the best and worst in everyone. So try to capture that vibe with the song.
Oh, that's great. How has it been that you've been doing this for 10 years and you haven't written a Christmas song before this?
You know, it's almost, it sneaks up on you. I think every year Christmas kind of sneaks up on us. But we're touring the whole, you know, we're always constantly on the road. So when things kind of start to slow down after Thanksgiving, then we're like, oh, we got to throw, you know, let's get this Christmas show together. And so it's just kind of one of those things where it's, you know, you're writing music throughout the year. And then when it finally comes down to it, you're like, oh, okay, did not think about this. So yeah, I guess just with being an independent band and being on the road all the time, it's one of those things that kind of always falls through the cracks. But with Diamond Sounds, our studio, we finally have the opportunity to where it's like, if you want to do whatever you want to do, we can just go in, knock it out. And it's not this whole process of booking studio time, seeing if an engineer is available and all that stuff. So it really was just having the luxury of the studio to where it's like, okay, yeah, if we want to do a Christmas song, we can easily knock that out. And that was kind of the, you know, it took down some of the barriers, you know, towards producing one, I guess.
Did having your own studio change the way you recorded it?
I think it kind of gave us more freedom to not feel like we're under the gun. Whereas when you're booking studio time, it's like, we've got to get this done right now, and we only have a certain window and who's available. So it just kind of gave you some breathing room to experiment a little bit more and, you know, try some different things out. So it definitely, you know, it definitely frees us up to be more creative, I feel like.
Have you had ideas for Christmas songs before and just didn't get to them?
I think so. I mean, I think that as a musician, you're always kind of writing something or have some different ideas. For this in particular, like I said, you know, Christmas just kind of, it's not like it's an afterthought, but you're just so focused on either working on new music and these other things that it's kind of this anomaly that just kind of creeps up on you. And then you're like, oh, okay, I should probably, you know, think about this. But that being said, I love, you know, I think the whole band loves Christmas music. And you know, it's weird in New Orleans. There's almost this subgenre of Christmas music with, you know, the Aaron Neville Christmas, Vince Vance, and the Valiants does his thing, you know, and then you got the 12 Yachts and all that stuff. So I think there's this, it's a weird culture in New Orleans where it's like most things in New Orleans, you have your traditional, you know, national Christmas, but then you have all these other strange local customs with Mr. Bingle and, you know, all this other stuff that's just like, where did this come from? And, you know, so it's kind of, it's like all New Orleans music where that's a interesting slant on something that I guess is celebrated, you know, internationally. But
I got to tell you one to check out that Steve Suter, program director at Magic 101, turned me on to. He will play in their, fold into their holiday music. I want to say it's Brenda Lee, but it's Père Noël, Papa Noël.
Okay.
And it sounds like a Cajun song. And
yeah.
It's a Cajun rhythm. It's like, I swear I've never heard of this. No, I've never read about it. And I got right here and he played it, and like I checked it once he told me about it and said, that's a great Christmas song. And was a great Louisiana Christmas song. Why did you start doing the Christmas show in the first place?
I think we always saw it as an opportunity. We wanted to do an event, you know, normally once a year or something, to where it's like, okay, this will be our event. And we were just looking at kind of the musical landscape at the time, and there wasn't that many Christmas themed shows or different things like that. And we were also wanted it to be an opportunity to bring some of our friends on. Like if we do a jazz fest show or something, you can normally get some different musicians, but for us, it was just a good opportunity to be like, well, we know people will be in town, and it'll be a good chance to just do a branded event that we can do year after year, and that, you know, people, you know, dig and would come out and just kind of be a nice little cap on the year before New Year's and all that stuff.
What I was wondering about particularly was, you know, as you know, imagine there's a limited number of times you can play in the year without, you know, in New Orleans without wearing out your audience.
Definitely, yeah.
And that I would kind of guess that sort of having a special event would be a way to make sure that you can, you know, you can basically get the, you know, get people to come and see you one more time because you're only going to see this show. Once a year.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's definitely a big part of it. You know, in any market, you're kind of pushing it if you know, we try to do like 3 to 4 times a year, like throughout the country and stuff, but especially in New Orleans where we, you know, it's our biggest fan base, that you don't want to overdo it or anything like that. So yeah, it kind of serves a dual purpose of, this is not just a Flow Tribe show. This is but it's got its own thing. It's got its own flavor. So yeah, it's definitely an event unto itself. So that helps.
Yeah, this is part of what interests me about Christmas music is that as much as it is obviously a musical thing, that it's almost always been at some level, you know, a business proposition.
Right.
And
yeah.
You know that you know, if you go back to the, you go back to the 40s and 50s and into the 60s, and you had, you know, sort of the pre-British invasion, that in that kind of pop era, that a Christmas pop song was kind of like a time out from your career. You know,
right.
it's not the music that you had made your, you know, that you'd earned your fan base on. And once you got past Christmas, you'd be working, you know, back into your genre, or working into your, your milieu. But for a moment, you're making music that says, you know, I'm not romantic guy, or I'm not, you know, leading lady. Right now, I'm just a guy wishing you a Merry Christmas. And it's that kind of interlude. But at the same time, it's very clearly audience service. It's fan service. It's trying to stay in front of the audience and trying to stay on the marketplace.
Right.
And so, you know, it's always been a, you know, it's always been business.
With White Christmas being the number one single of all time, I think that once that happened, I guess it was in the 50s or late 40s or something, that people were like, light bulbs went off and like, we can get a check every year, you know, in the mail from this. And it's kind of the gift that keeps on giving. And like that, you know, Christmas has been so commercialized in every other aspect that it only made sense for, you know, music to get a cut of that. But that being said, there is a real need for, there's something about the holiday season where people, you know, it's like looking for that light in the darkness. They're looking for something that, you know, as maybe as manufactured or whatever as these songs are, you know, so when you hear Mariah Carey or you do, you know, you hear the Drifters or the Coasters singing, you know, butter, butter, dub, dub, that White Christmas, like, it's just, it's a nostalgia shot. It's a, it's kind of a time warp back to when you were little. I mean, I you know, if I hear Alvin, I picture myself being 10 and trying to get the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle action figures, you know. So it's like there's these emotional triggers that, you know, wrapped in a commercial package, I guess, but there still is a genuine need for these songs at this time, I feel like. And it does kind of bring you back to your childhood, which, you know, that's kind of what music does.
Sure. Yeah, it's I want to say, now this would be probably about 7 or 8 years ago, I remember seeing a story, you know, that Wonderful Christmas Time earns McCartney about another 100,000 a year. You know, like that's got to be like, you know, in a like a 2.5 month period,
wow,
he pulls another 100 grand.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know how, and especially today with the streaming services, I mean, this, us releasing this single is more just to kind of, just to do it, you know, and just to kind of raise attention about the Tipitina show and different things like that, because you just don't really see any money unless you're in the millions of plays. And even then, you don't really see any money. So the calculus has kind of changed to where it's like, now when you're releasing a song, you're really hoping that you can just build fans in these different markets and that, you know, you're just going to show people what you're working on and these different things. And yeah, you hope you get placement and all this other stuff. But you know, the reality of the modern music business and like a middle-class band like we are is just put stuff out and, you know, you hope that you can just develop this fan base that'll be into it and all this other stuff. And that's why it really pays. That's why the impetus for us to get the studio up and running has been so great these past years, because, you know, touring alone, you just, there's so many options and there's so many distractions to where it's like you really just need to put out music all the time to show people that you're working and, you know, this is, you're being creative and stuff. So it's just a weird, you know, it's the Wild West out there. I mean, people really don't know the formula to make something work, but if something catches on, then they try to squeeze everything they can out of it.
Sure. Well, you know, the thing that's interesting I think about Christmas music is I think it's largely tailor-made for streaming,
right.
Because, you know, I've got hundreds of Christmas albums.
Right.
And there's very few of them that I want to listen to as albums. I have a lot of music, I have a lot of songs on that I like, but that's usually what I want to do. What I almost always end up doing is, you know, is picking highlights and, you know, making a mix, you know,
right,
for a few hours. But it's, you know, you don't really want to hear a full album of anybody at that time.
That's true.
So, you know, it's interesting. I think, you know, economically streaming is hard for everybody, but
right,
musically, actually, I think that, you know, Christmas music is just, you know, is built for this, and that
it really is.
Does this make you want to make more Christmas music?
Definitely. I mean, I think that, you know, going forward, like I said, the studio just, it eliminates a lot of barriers to cranking this stuff out. So, yeah, I mean, I could see us, you know, doing another Christmas tune. you know, it might just be a tradition where every year we just come out with another little Christmas ditty, you know, and I'm not against it. I think the guys like it, and it's a fun project to kind of take your mind off of, because there's just different, I feel like there's different expectations for a Christmas song as well. Obviously, you got to put the best product you have out there, but at the same time, people are expecting something different. You know, there's a certain style that they're looking for or something. So
yeah,
it's not that much pressure. I mean, it's just like, all right, let's do something that kind of has that vibe and just roll with it.
Cool.
You're not writing Dark Side of the Moon, you know. You're just...
We're hammered on Christmas this year.
Thanks to Casey O'Rourke and Rodney Crowell for the time and the talk. You can follow Rodney and Flow Tribe on Facebook, where you can also find 12 Songs of Christmas. Stop by and leave a comment. I'd love to hear from you. Our theme song is Dawn of the Cosmos by Ask Again. And I'll wrap up today with one more from Rodney Crowell's Christmas Everywhere. This is Come Christmas. Talk to you next week.
Christmas makes me stop and wonder where you are. Just like every other day I've seen so far. To make believe this Christmas Eve that you'll come home. No more to roam is madness, I can't let myself go near. 'Tis the season.